If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
As I'm sure you already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. And if you haven't had a chance to get hold of our magazine recently, we'd like to offer you the chance to get a copy of our next issue absolutely free. Please text the word HISTORY to 78070 to request your free magazine today. One of our team will be in touch to organise delivery direct to your door. This offer is available for a limited time only and only available for UK residents. So please don't miss out. Text HISTORY to 78070 to get your free copy today. Just a quick note, texts are normally charged at your standard network rate. Please check with your provider for further details. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. Today's episode is the latest in our Everything You Wanted to Know But Were Too Afraid to Ask series. The subject this time around is the Spanish Civil War, which tore Spain apart from 1936 to 1939. Our expert is one of the world's leading historians on the conflict, Professor Paul Preston. And putting the questions to him was our editor, Rob Attar.
For today's episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Paul Preston, who is a historian based at LSE. He's one of the world's leading experts on the Spanish Civil War and has written widely on the conflict with books including The Spanish Civil War, The Spanish Holocaust and a biography of Franco. So in today's interview, I'll be asking him a range of questions about the war, some taken from popular internet search queries and many sent in by you via our social media channels. So Paul, welcome to the podcast. To begin with, when did the Spanish Civil War begin?
Well, the actual, I mean, that is actually a much more complicated question than you might think. The standard date given is the 18th of July 1936. And on the right in Spain, the Spanish Civil War is almost always referred to as El 18 de Julio, the 18th of July. actually, I mean, the military coup that triggered it started on the evening of the 17th in Morocco. The Spanish colonial army rose in the late afternoon of the 17th. I mean, in a way, Spain was at war for, or, you know, the extreme right was on a war footing for quite some time before then.
And so what were the underlying causes of the conflict?
Well, you know, in a way, one could actually start with the cavemen, but, you know, we haven't got that much time. Essentially, what happens is that, I mean, Spain is highly conflictive for many reasons. It's a conflictive society. It's a very uneven, very unjust society. And it is under immense pressure right up to 1923. Things get very tense during the First World War, where, ironically, Spain is not a combatant in the First World War. But Spain undergoes a great boom because it can supply both sides in the war. However, this leads to massive inflation because anything that can be moved, whether it's manufactured goods or agricultural produce, is exported. So it leads, on the one hand, to massive fortunes being made, but on the other, to huge inflation, food, you know, starvation in many areas and so on. So this intensifies social conflict. This goes on basically until 1923, when it is temporarily resolved by the imposition of a dictatorship, which is absolutely riddled with the most mind-boggling corruption. This is under somebody called General Miguel Primo de Rivera. It's not a particularly violent dictatorship. It's not like the Franco regime. And it finally comes to an end, first of all, in 1930, the ruling classes and the monarchy try to resolve things by a gradual return to the constitutional monarchy. That doesn't work. And because of huge popular pressure, on the 14th of April 1931, a republic is established. Now, that republic, Spain's Second Republic, in a way, because of its ambitions, you could argue, if you were of a conservative turn of mind, that's why there was a Spanish Civil War, because what the Republic tries to do is introduce a huge raft of reforms. It tries to introduce popular education, which had virtually not existed before. It introduces sweeping rights for women, including, for the first time in Spain, divorce. It tries to introduce very, very complicated agrarian reform. It's complicated because they try to ensure there's compensation for landowners. So they try to introduce all kinds of social welfare rights and so on. The government is a coalition of socialists, and most of what I've said so far is about the ambitions of the socialist, and it's a coalition of the socialist with what are called republicans. Now, that's another can of worms, because first of all, one has to say republicans, it's not like republicans in America. Republicans in Spain mean liberals, basically, and at this stage, right? So the republicans are the sort of bourgeois liberals. Their ambitions are more legal and theoretical. So what they want to do is to limit the power of the Catholic Church, its monopoly of education and so on, and also to limit the immense power of the army, which over, you know, the previous 50-odd years had dominated Spanish politics, believing that it was the army's right to dictate the political direction. Now, these two sets of ambitions together were a potent mix, because it meant that the socialist ones clearly offended or challenged landowners, industrialists, and bankers, whereas the Republicans' aims challenged the church, which controlled the hearts and minds of many people, and the army, which was the Praetorian Guard that looked after the economic and social interest of all of those other areas, the landowners, the industrialists, etc., who were being challenged by the socialists. So the Republic, literally in 1931, had bitten off an enormous amount. And of course, it raised amazing hopes. People danced in the street when, you know, there are lots of wonderful photos of people dancing in the street in celebration of the arrival of the Republic. But of course, what happened was virtually on, you know, the afternoon of the 14th of April, 1931, military conspiracy is already starting. And huge resources, and of course, the control of the press and so on, huge resources are put into, if you like, building the atmosphere that will justify eventually a military uprising. The first one actually takes place on the 10th of August, 1932. It's a failure, and the conspirators learn a lot from that. So what the military conspiracy that bears fruit in July 1936 draws on the lessons of the failed military coup of August 1932.
So when the war does break out in 1936, who are the two sides? I know we're calling one side the Republicans, but I believe you don't call the other side the Nationalists when you're writing about them.
No, I mean, the reason I don't is simply that, of course, the term national at the time, the press at the time, tended to refer to the Nationalists and the Loyalists. Loyalists because loyal to the legal regime, and the Nationalists because Franco and, you know, his entire apparatus referred to itself as the Los Nacionales, not Los Nacionalistas, which would be Nationalists, but Los Nacionales, which literally means, you know, well, the Nationals, as if they were the Spaniards and the others were somehow foreign. And that, of course, was part of the narrative, that what they were trying to do was to put an end or control or to destroy those who they claimed were dominated by evil foreign influences, by what to use the phrase of the time, the Jewish Bolshevik Masonic conspiracy. So the two sides, insofar as there were two sides, on the one hand, the Francoist side, which I usually refer to as the rebels, because they were military rebels, that is pretty homogenous. It's pretty tightly organized. From day one, they are under military discipline. On the other side, of course, the Republican side, it's a very different kettle of fish, because the Republic is a democracy. So what you have within the Republic is a whole range of forces, ranging from anarchists and Trotskyists on the far left, right through communists, who were pretty conservative, strangely enough, during the Civil War, through the socialist movement, and then back into these liberal Republicans that I was talking about earlier. So, of course, what that means is the rebel side is united throughout, whereas the Republic can be very deeply divided.
And actually, that comes on to a question that we had from David Shuker on Twitter. And he just asked simply, why couldn't all the leftist factions get their act together?
It is a sort of genetic problem of the left that the wider view is very rarely seen. I mean, the same question is, why did the German left allow Hitler to come to power? Because, you know, the communists were too busy attacking the socialists to unite. So that is the basic reason. I mean, there is a genuine, you know, a broad answer to the question, which is the one I've just given. Specifically, I mean, and this is simplifying quite a lot, there were two really fundamental views on how the war should be fought. So on the one hand, the socialists, the Republicans, and the communists, very much with the influence of the Soviet Union, when that influence came to play a role from basically late September of 1936, who believed that the only answer was a kind of conventional war effort. So that meant centralizing resources, etc. The other view, which was the view on the left, which was the anarchists and the Trotskyists, who wanted to see a revolutionary war. Now, it always seemed to me the only way that that would be remotely possible would be if they could have got together. I mean, I'm now being very sarcastic. The only way it would have happened if they had kind of contacted Franco and said, would you mind holding off for 5 or 6 years while we make our revolution? And then when we've done that, we'll start the war again. In other words, it was completely bonkers. I mean, there was already huge hostility of the great powers. You know, I think this is a key thing we need to look at. Hitler and Mussolini were very much on Franco's side. They wanted to see another fascist state on France's southern borders. Plus, of course, what Hitler and Mussolini were doing was trying to undermine the hegemony of international relations held by Britain and France. Britain and France, on the other hand, were so terrified by the threat of the Soviet Union, they were worried about there being a Soviet Spain. Now, there was never the slightest chance of there being a Soviet Spain, but that was their fear. And so particularly in London, where it's the British who call the shots, Britain's foreign policy makers put their class and political prejudices ahead of national interests. So basically, Britain and France, by the whole farce, the fraud of non-intervention, which basically deprived the Republic of its rights at international law to defend itself, to buy arms and so on, they stood aside, effectively covertly helping Hitler and Mussolini. And it was when that became very obvious that the Russians, who had been desperate not to get involved, finally realised that if the ambitions of Hitler and, to a lesser extent, Mussolini, were not to be achieved very quickly, they would have to help the Republic. And the anarchists, the other thing about the anarchists, of course, was that some of the extreme policies, well, not policy, but particularly the, for want of a better word, the antics of the extreme factions of the anarchists and the Trotskyists in terms of collectivizing industry, the banks and so on, which are absolutely laudable at one level, but of course convinced the great powers that, you know, that they were about to see their economic interests in Spain go under. The atrocities that were... there's a real irony here. The rebels were committing atrocities on an industrial scale. That was a central part of their policy. The Republic, which is trying to present an image of moderation, hence, it is against a revolutionary war. It is doing everything it can to curtail the atrocities and so on. But everything that the anarchists do makes it harder for the Republic to secure the support of Britain and France. And one of the really, again, sort of obvious reasons for this is that, particularly in the early months of the war, where the rebels were, there were no diplomats. They kept a very tight control over foreign correspondence and so on. So they could effectively carry out their mass atrocities under cover of silence. Whereas, of course, in Madrid and Barcelona, there were diplomats, consuls, and a huge foreign press corps, which meant that the atrocities committed by the extreme left were fully publicized. And it was very, very difficult to get to see the other side. So they were really the two big things. On the one hand, the socialists, the Republicans, and the communists aiming at moderation and a conventional war effort. And on the other, the extreme left aiming at a revolutionary war.
And then on the other side, what can you tell us about Franco and how he came to prominence?
Well, Franco, of course, is a mysterious figure at this time. He has made a name for it. I mean, his ambition is mind-boggling. I mean, right from a very young age, his rapid promotions through the army, the colonial army, were very, you know, they didn't just happen because of bravery, which is the conventional view. You know, he worked very hard on that, trying to, you know, put influence on various people. But it is certainly the case that he gets to rise through the ranks very, very quickly. By 1922, he's head of the Spanish Foreign Legion. That is very important. It's the most important bit of the Spanish armed forces are totally ramshackle. Spain has more generals and senior officers per 100 men than virtually any other army in Europe. You know, it at this stage, in terms of being an effective fighting force, it's on a par with Montenegro and Portugal and so on. But Franco, you know, builds a big reputation. During the dictatorship of Primo de Rivera, he gets to be made head of the military academy. So he has enormous influence. And of course, in the military academy, he trains a whole cohort of close followers. Now, during the Republic, he has a number of quite important posts, but he hates the Republic because the first thing, or one of the very first things, as part of the anti-militaristic drive, is to close down the very expensive military academy of which he's head. Nonetheless, he's very, very cautious. There's a swing to the right between 1933 and 1935. And in 1934, he gets made chief of the general staff. And he uses his power as chief of the general staff to do many things that helped what would later be the role of the rebels during the Civil War. However, in the spring of 1936, he's very hesitant. At the time, he's the military commander of the Canary Islands. They've sent him to the Canary Islands, hoping to get him out of the way. I mean, there was a conclave of generals in March of 36, and the government took the precaution of sending them all to remote places in the hope of neutralizing them. Franco was in the Canary Islands. And they needed him, the rest of the conspirators needed him because of his immense prestige with the Foreign Legion, which was the only bit, if you like, of the Spanish army that was really effective. I mean, it wasn't a great fighting force in the way that the British or German armies were, but for the kind of colonial war that was to be carried out against the peasantry of the south of Spain in the early months, it was the perfect instrument. So the conspirators needed Franco. So in a very complicated circumstances, with the aid probably of the British Secret Service, they managed to get him to Morocco. He's flown from the Canary Islands to Morocco, takes charge of the African army, which consists of the Foreign Legion and what are called the regulares indígenas, the native regulars, which I, you know, it's a sort of quite common in colonial armies. You know, it's a mercenary force, very powerful mercenary force. And then in early August, he manages to get it across the Straits of Gibraltar. Now, whereas all the other generals are thinking in terms of how do we win the war, it's quite obvious that what Franco is working on is him getting to be leader. Now, he has a huge advantage. Obviously, he's the head of the colonial army. He's helped by the fact that the man who was supposed to be leader dies in an airplane accident on the very first day. He's in exile in Portugal, General Sanjurjo, and flying to Spain, he actually dies in a plane crash. And Franco already, this is astonishing, you know, in early August, he's already set up a press office. So it's quite interesting that long before it's actually the case, if you look at the international press in this time, Franco is already described as head of the rebel forces, which is actually not yet true. It's not until really the end of September, formally the 1st of October, that he's made head of the rebel forces.
How far would you say it's appropriate to describe either Franco or the nationalist rebel troops as fascist?
I think that gets us into the whole area of, you know, what does fascist mean? I mean, it's like, you know, if people are looking for a quick and easy insult to those on the right, then fascist is your go-to term. If you're asking an academic, you know, political theorist, what constitutes a fascist, then you'd have to say Franco isn't. I caused quite a stir in Spain a few years ago when asked this question, And I said, Franco wasn't a fascist. Pause. He was something much worse. Now, what I meant by that was that, you know, I would always start from the basis that the only absolutely indisputable fascist leader is Mussolini. The only absolutely indisputable fascist party is the Partito Fascista Italiano. The only indisputably fascist regime is Mussolini's regime. Now, there are so many ways in which Franco is different. So basically, when I went on to he was something much worse, I went on, he was an Africanista. That's to say, he had the mental furniture, if you like, of the Spanish colonial officer. So basically, he was deeply conservative, had absolutely no qualms about, you know, one of the very first interviews that he does at the beginning of the war is, you know, he says, you know, I'll soon control all of Spain. This journalist, an American called Jay Allen, says, but that means you'd have to shoot half of Spain. And he says, if that's what's necessary, that's what will be done. So now, you know, I don't think Mussolini ever planned on shooting half of Italy. So in that sense, I mean, technically, no. I would say they're not fascists. But, you know, at the time, you know, why did the international brigaders come to Spain? I mean, everybody who opposed Franco reasonably described themselves as an anti-fascist because, of course, Franco, I mean, so it's a technicality, no, he's not a fascist, but he's so much part of what will be the Axis, although he never actually joins, but that's a whole other complicated issue. But he's so close to Hitler and Mussolini and their ambitions that the, you know, the opposition to Franco is especially from those from outside Spain, is we have to stop fascism in Spain, because if we don't, it will be Paris being bombed and it will be London being bombed. In that sense, yes, it's not so much that Franco was a fascist, but that the opposition to him was very much anti-fascist.
And then coming on to that opposition, we had some people asking about the international brigades. And Vansa David on Facebook wanted to know, how much did infighting among the international brigades contribute to Republican defeat?
I would say not at all. I think, you know, there was clearly infighting on the left. I mean, very little that actually led to, you know, considerable violence. That there was infighting in the sense that, precisely going back to what I was saying before about the difference between, you know, the government view and the, you know, the Republican, the Socialist and the Communist view, you need to fight a conventional war. And obviously the international brigades were very much about that. They were an instrument of that policy. The only time where infighting on the left caused serious problems, I mean, obviously there's an undertow of anarchists bumping off communists and communists bumping off anarchists, but, you know, we're not talking massive. That, you know, it's not the reason why the Republic loses the war. But there are times, for instance, in May of 1937, when the Trotskyists withdraw their forces from the front, which is, you know, a serious danger to the Republican war effort. But within the international brigades, no. I mean, despite the fact that their conditions were appalling, they were used as shock troops. They, you know, unlike normal troops, you know, they were hardly ever given any leave. They, you know, they faced really difficult conditions. And of course, there were deserters, and the deserters that were caught were shot, or some were imprisoned. You know, it was very difficult once you were in the international brigades to leave, but the numbers who wanted to leave were tiny. And, you know, until the international brigades were formally withdrawn in October 1938, I mean, I would say, if the question, you know, was there ever any infighting? Probably a bit. You know, the British and the Irish didn't get on very well. But not, you know, this is not a serious deficit, if you like, in the war effort.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Generations of Spaniards were brought up to believe that, you know, Franco had saved Spain from the hordes of Moscow and so on and so forth. And when democracy came back, precisely because it was a democracy, there wasn't a counter-brainwashing.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Now, a couple of listeners wanted to know about the Catalan and Basque components to the story. Did these regions find themselves particularly on either side of the conflict?
Well, on both the Basque country and Catalonia, of course, formally supported the Republic. And that was because, in the case of Catalonia, autonomy had been granted to Catalonia in 1932, and a statute of autonomy was actually going through Parliament and the courts just when the Spanish Civil War started. Now, it was a great surprise on the part of many that the Basques supported the Republic, because the Basque country was deeply Catholic in the main, although there's a very powerful socialist movement. But the Basque country remained loyal to the Republic until it was overthrown by, of course, the Francoist assault with the help of the Luftwaffe, including, of course, the bombing of Guernica, all of that. The Basques remained loyal until they had no choice, which would be basically the fall of Bilbao in June of 1937. Catalonia remained loyal to the Republic until it fell, until it was invaded. Barcelona was conquered on the 26th of January 1939. However, there was always the complaint that, there were two problems as far as Catalonia was concerned. There were the anarchists who were arguably undermining the Republican war effort. The anarchists were not Catalan nationalists. So that was one issue. So the way in which they undermined the Republic was because of revolutionary policies that were in contradiction with, the basic government's policy. But there was also the nationalist issue. The Catalans wanted to run their own war effort. They were reluctant to get involved in, obeying the national government. And that really was an issue. And it's interesting, actually, I've recently been reading quite a lot of memoir stuff about how a lot of people in Barcelona during the war until quite late, didn't really take on board that there was a war on. You know, there was a sense, you know, this is not our war. Now, I'm talking about up to the middle of 1937. But there was always, you know, there's still to this day, I mean, there's a lot of academic controversy over did Catalonia play its part on the side of the Republic? I mean, if I had to, you know, back to the wall, if I had to say yes or no, I'd say yes, it did. But it's a complicated issue.
And in that last answer, you alluded briefly to Guernica. And we had a question from Mark James on Facebook, and he wrote, why is the bombing of Guernica controversial when it was a military target? And in any case, the RAF had already carried out area bombing in Iraq in the 1920s.
Well, Guernica becomes an issue for a number of reasons. It's quite right that, of course, it's not the first bombing of undefended civilian targets. But in the world of 1937, what happened in the Middle East was not something that bothered people in the way it would today. So it was the first example of the bombing of an undefended civilian target in Europe, as far as I know. So that's one element. Guernica is not a military target. There's nothing there to bomb, really. And I mean, this is such a complicated issue. One simple answer would be Guernica became a big issue because of Picasso's painting. Now, the irony there is that if you look carefully at Picasso's painting, there's not a lot that is representative of what happened at Guernica. Why did Picasso do that painting? Well, he was commissioned to do a painting for the Republican Pavilion at the Great Exhibition. So that's why he started to do a painting. His motivation, his initial motivation, was twofold. It was what he'd read in the French press about the bombing of Madrid. And it was what happened in Malaga after it was captured in February 37, which was his own hometown. And basically, if you look at the photo, it's not the photo, if you look at the detail of the painting, there's much more of that. When it was quite advanced, Guernica took place. And one of his friends, I think it may have even been Louis Aragon, said to him, why don't you call the painting Guernica? It would have much more impact. So obviously that painting has become absolutely iconic, rightly so. So that, you know, that's one reason. There's the fact that, I mean, actually, it wasn't the first, I said earlier, and I'm thinking about it, I'm wrong. It wasn't the first bombing of an undefended civilian town. That was Durango, which was, you know, taking place a couple of weeks before in the Basque Country. But the actual attack on Guernica, what I'm about to say, derived from very recent research. What it was actually about was the German tactic of coordinated ground air attacks. And what they wanted to do was to put a block in the way of the retreating Basque army. So the aim was, I mean, the roads, the crossroads where they would have been coming through was through Guernica. And so it was a question of that. Everything about the attack was about causing civilian havoc. So Guernica was mainly, the buildings were made of wood. The first targets were actually the fire brigade and the water system, so fires couldn't be put out. There was something called the Feuerring, the ring of fire, which was a set of fighter planes that just zoomed round and round the town in order to machine gun any civilians who were fleeing. It was, and the only safe place to be was actually underneath the stone bridge, which is where the fleeing troops would have had to cross. The bomb loads were all incendiary bombs. You don't knock out a stone bridge with incendiary bombs. So, I mean, Guernica is important as a, you know, as a terrible atrocity. There's huge controversy to this day about the number of dead. You know, bodies are still being discovered. I mean, it's a very, very complicated issue. But it's important also because, of course, it has a devastating effect on Basque morale. You know, it's the, it is the spiritual capital of the Basque country. So, you know, the attack, and that was part of the reason for choosing it. You know, there were many reasons that went into it. Another one which has been put forward, because the actual bombing took place on the 26th of April. There's a major researcher into this who said that the original plan was to do it a week before as a birthday present for Hitler. I haven't seen documentation of this, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence.
You've already alluded to a few of these, but what would you say were the main reasons for the nationalist or rebel victory?
Well, and I think that's actually, you know, the reasons really are the international context. The Republic is severely let down by Britain and France. It was in the interest of Britain and France to support the Spanish Republic, but they didn't do it. So that, plus, you know, the unstinted help of Mussolini and the much more stinted but much more targeted help of Hitler are the key reasons. And I know people always come back and say, ah, yes, but what about the Russians? Well, the Russians were also fighting in the Far East. There were limits on how much help the Russians could give. And of course it was important in keeping the Republic alive, but in the end it just wasn't enough. I mean, the key reasons above all else are, I think, you know, British and French foreign policy, German and Italian aid, and of course, I mean, the internal divisions that I've talked about before, which were, if you like, I mean, it's an irony. Without Russian aid, the Republic couldn't have survived. But the very fact of Russian aid exacerbated those divisions in some quarters.
And the issue with Britain and France was that they wouldn't help the Republic, wasn't it? They weren't on the nationalist side, but they wouldn't help the Republic.
Well, in fact, you know, there's a very strong case for saying that the British establishment was very much on Franco's side. I mean, there's a wonderful quote that I use in one of my books. I actually quote an interesting remark where, and I'm trying to remember, this is the British chargé d'affaires in Italy, and he's talking to, I seem to remember, Ciano, who's the Mussolini's foreign minister. And Ciano says to him, I notice that Portugal is giving every bit of aid possible to the Francoists. Would I be right in thinking that given that Portugal acts almost as a satellite of Britain, that that means that that one could take it that Britain is happy with Portuguese support for Franco and therefore for other support for Franco? I mean, I'm making this a bit more explicit than it was. And the reply from the British diplomat is, you've interpreted this in its precise significance. The Italian diplomatic documents are full of reports back. Oh, I've just spoken to the head of the Tory party. I've just spoken, you know, that there's little doubt that, with very few exceptions, the British establishment is on the side of Franco. Interesting case in this is Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill, I would say he wrote a book. He put together a book called Step by Step at the end of the Spanish Civil War, which contains his newspaper articles during that period when he himself was, if you like, in the wilderness. And they show a remarkable trajectory. At the beginning of the war, he's writing, he's saying, I'm an aristocrat. If I was Spanish, I would have to support Franco because people like me are being massacred and so on. And everything that the rebels stand for is what I stand for. And over time, he moved to saying, given that what most matters to me in life is the British Empire, is the security of the British Empire, I have come to believe that Britain should be supporting the Spanish Republic. And that in its way, I think, is a very good indication of the extent to which the British ruling classes had put their class prejudice before their geostrategic interests.
One more popular search query is, how many people died in the Spanish Civil War?
Well, that's quite a difficult question to answer. So we'll do, if you like, innocent civilians or civilians behind the lines first. In order to calculate that, you need to know the names, and that's quite difficult. However, because the Francoists, having won, went to immense trouble to locate the bodies of those who'd been killed, to identify them, to commemorate them, to mourn them, whatever. We know within 100 or so that the number of people murdered behind the Republican lines was 50,000. It's a horrendous figure. On the basis of massive research done by Spanish local historians, where they've been allowed to do so. So there's areas of Spain that, because they are, you know, have right-wing town councils or whatever, this work has not been permitted. But we have the names, you know, indubitably, we have the names of 135,000 people. Now, of course, there are, I don't put a number, the number of unmarked graves around Spain, the places where no research has been done. So I think it is, and most Spanish researchers on this would say the same, the number of civilians killed behind the rebel lines has got to be at least 150,000, because of, you know, we know the places where lots of people were killed, but we don't know all the names. And if we add in the places where no research has been possible, it could get as high as 200,000. So let's say, you know, we're talking in terms of civilians, somewhere between 200 and 250,000. I mean, that's quite a margin of error. In terms of deaths in the battlefield, I think we're talking about, again, somewhere between 200 and 250,000. A lot is not known, of course, because certainly on the Republican side, lots of people went into exile. You know, I mean, soldiers at the end, not everybody knows who managed to cross the border. Huge numbers of Republican soldiers were put in concentration camps and died there. I mean, it's not a simple issue. There were nearly 1 million people in concentration camps after the end, you know, the end of actual hostilities in the war. So it's very difficult. But there was a monumentally best-selling book in Spain called A Million Dead in the early 60s, I think it was, by a guy called Gironella. I would say total, if you're looking for a ballpark figure, 500,000.
And we had a question that came in from the BBC radio presenter Kavita Puri, and she asked, has Spain ever come to terms with its past, and is there something about civil war that makes memorialisation particularly difficult?
Well, the short answer is no, Spain has not come to terms with its past. And the reasons for that are complicated. The under the Franco regime, there was a kind of national brainwashing. So, you know, Franco was in power till 1975, and indeed, Francoism, the dictatorship, continued formally, at least, until 1977. During that time, there was total control of the media, total control of the education system, and, of course, particularly in the early years, it was a regime based on terror. So generations of Spaniards were brought up to believe that, you know, Franco had saved Spain from the hordes of Moscow and so on and so forth. And when democracy came back, precisely because it was a democracy, there wasn't a counter brainwashing. So, you know, freedom of speech, all those people who thought that Franco was the bee's knees continued to think that, and to this day continue to think that. I mean, it is astonishing. There exists in Spain, you can imagine this in Germany, but in Spain there exists something called the Fundación Nacional Francisco Franco, the National Francisco Franco Foundation. Could you imagine if there was a Stiftung Adolf Hitler? It is quite remarkable. You know, so the first thing that happened, or one of the very first things that happened when democracy comes back, first elections in June of 1977. On the 15th of October of 1977, an amnesty is passed. And this amnesty is the basis of what is called the Pact of Forgetting, which you must have heard of, El Pacto de Silencio, the Pact of Oblivion, or the Pact of Forgetting, which has no legal basis. Basically, this amnesty says nobody can be prosecuted either for crimes against humanity committed in the name of Franco and his dictatorship, or of those guilty of crimes of terrorism against it. Now, the numerical differences between those two concepts are gigantic. You know, on the one hand, we're talking about the 150,000 to 200,000 murdered by the Francoists. And acts of terrorism after the war are basically the guerrilla war in the late 40s and the terrorism of ETA. You know, I don't know how many, but we're talking about hundreds at most. You know, so there's a huge difference. But nonetheless, because there is a civic desire never to risk another civil war, never to risk another dictatorship, the whole idea of examining the historical memory issues is shelved. And it's shelved for a very, very long time. And nothing happens till 2006, 2007, when there is, with the socialists back in power, a law of historical memory. But the law of historical memory is constrained by costs, because it leaves the implementation, you know, the excavation of bodies, the DNA testing, all of that, to local authorities who simply don't have the money. So it remains an issue. It became a huge issue round about the year 2000, because, I mean, the first generation, those who'd suffered under Franco, were obviously, you know, silent. Their kids were brought up silent. Do not, you know, do not rock the boat. This is dangerous. But the grandchildren, by about the year 2007, were starting to ask questions. And that gave a huge boost to the search for bodies and so on. And of course, and encouraged all these local historians. I mean, my book, The Spanish Holocaust, derives enormous benefit from the research that was done as a result of this. So it became a burning issue. It's a bit on the back burner at the moment because there are so many other mega problems, but it hasn't gone away. Now, back to your questioner's question, is this a given, you know, is this a constant of civil wars? I think the answer would have to be not necessarily. I mean, take the American Civil War. There are people who support Trump who fly Confederate flags. But there was an effort at reconciliation. after the American Civil War. And that's one of the things that categorically was not under Franco. And in many countries, Argentina is an obvious case, South Africa, you know, have had truth and reconciliation commissions, which have done a lot to defuse some of these issues. So, yes, they are necessarily a constant consequence of civil wars, but how much they are allowed, these issues are allowed to fester, is different in each case. And it's been particularly shocking in the case of Spain.
And then just before you go, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your latest book, A People Betrayed, which I know is a broader look at Spanish history, but the Spanish Civil War must come into that.
Yes, I mean, it's a book that I was asked to do. And what I was asked to do is certainly not what I ended up doing. You know, I was asked, you know, just do a history of Spain from, you know, the middle of the 19th century to present day. It'll be an absolute doddle. You've covered it all before. And I felt uneasy till the first day I started. And I thought, you know, I do not want to do that. I don't want to just do a kind of anthology of everything I've written before. How can I make it different and original and interesting for me? And the more I thought about it, I came up with, if you like, almost a mathematical equation, which could be applied to any country, which was that corruption plus political incompetence equals social division. Now, that is very much the case. It's the case in Spain, obviously. I was writing the book under the shadow of Brexit, which, if you like, inclined me ever more to believe in the validity of my little equation. And so basically I set out, you know, to write this book. And there were huge areas that, you know, I didn't actually know so much about. And I was almost shocked. I mean, the scale of, first of all, of corruption is absolutely eye-watering. So much so, in some cases, it's almost comical. I, as some people may have noticed, have a bit of a sense of humour. And I, although some of what I was writing about was terrible, it was so grotesque that you couldn't help laughing. I mean, particularly during the Primo de Rivera dictatorship, which was riddled with corruption on the scale you cannot imagine, that monopolies were being created, and each of these monopolies would have a kind of administration in each of Spain's 50 provinces, and there'd be jobs for the boys in each of those. There was even a rat extermination monopoly. I discovered stuff about the previous king of Spain, Alfonso XIII, was totally mired in corruption. There's a character who runs right through the book, who's, well, till the 1960s when he dies, called Juan Marc, who is, you know, a robber baron, if you like, one of the great, corrupt on an incredible scale, who actually bankrolls Franco's war effort in the early months of the Spanish Civil War, I mean, before the Germans and the Italians get involved. And some of he ran, you know, he started off as a tobacco smuggler, but some of the things that he did throughout his existence are, I mean, they are almost unbelievable. So the corruption side, you know, is a very strong part of the book. One of the great disappointments of the present democratic regime, one we've talked about, which is the failure to deal with the legacy of the Civil War. The other, which was absolutely unexpected, is the proliferation of corruption. And some of the cases that I discovered were, again, almost unbelievable. You know, bloke who's a municipal councillor, who, when the police start investigating him, they discover he has 6 estates. They do a search of one of them. He has a stable with over 100 Arab ponies. He has a collection of cars with several Rolls Royces, Bentleys, Ferraris, Aston Martins, the works. And all around the house, there are black rubbish bags full of cash. And when asked how he afforded all of this on his salary, said, you know, I've been very frugal. You know, so I mean, as I say, there are kind of comical elements. The political incompetence, I mean, it's easy with hindsight, of course, the great advantage of the historian. But one can look back at the Republic. I was talking before that, in a sense, it was the excessive weight of ambition that perhaps made inexperienced politicians fail to realise, you know, that they had bitten off more than they could chew. In the present situation, you know, the very conflictive issue in Spain at the moment over Catalan independence is something that, you know, the level of the mistakes made on both sides, again, I'm writing it thinking, I wish they'd asked me what to do instead of doing that, you know. And of course, Spain remains divided. So I felt that the, you know, the equation, what I call the equation in inverted commas, functioned quite well. So a book which I actually dreaded writing, so that I'm going to be bored out of my mind, ended up being absolutely riveting.
That was Paul Preston. As you've heard, his most recent book, A People Betrayed, was published by William Collins in March. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back tomorrow when Clement Knox will be discussing the history of seduction.